Okay, let's talk about hash functions. A hash function is a mapping from a type T to the unsigned index. It has to have two properties. Well, two definitions first. We often refer to the type that is defined as a key type, and we refer to the elements of that type as keys. And the corresponding value we call a signature or a hash value. So the two properties it has to have is, first of all, be that kind of mapping, and second, it has to be not one-to-one. So that there is no one-to-one correspondence between values and keys. And the reason, what this does is make it mathematically impossible to reverse the computation. So knowing the key, you cannot logically produce, I'm sorry, knowing the value cannot logically produce the key. Doesn't mean you might not be able to guess it, it's trial and error, but that's a different thing. There's no algorithm, there's no reversibility to the calculation. Not invertible. There are two principal uses of hash functions, and you're going to encounter both of these in this course. They're used for secure signatures, and they're used to make efficient tables. First, your project one uses hash functions for secure signatures. Your project four is going to use hash functions to make efficient tables. There are two attributes of a hash function that are kind of subjective, but nevertheless meaningful. One is called the enigma, and that is kind of how hard is it to guess. Remember, it's mathematically impossible to get a formula that gives you the key from the hash value. But how hard is it to guess from the signature back to the key? And that's kind of the enigma attribute. And what you want is that to be very difficult to do, and particularly you like for it to be computationally intractable to do. Because typically in a security environment, the hash function is known. It's a published entity. If your security depended on keeping the hash function secret, that's a losing game, because if you did that, then once the hash function got out, every system that used it would be immediately compromised by the loss of one secret. So that would be not the way to go. And so you do the opposite, you make it public, what the hash function is, and just make it hard, so hard that it's intractable and reverse it from the back of the table. Table efficiency is related to the pseudo-random attribute. And that is, the pseudo-random attribute is kind of like, well, suppose I calculate the hash values of a bunch of keys, take a collection of keys in my type T, take their hash values and look at those numbers. And what you would like is for that to look like a uniformly distributed collection of random numbers. So, even though of course they're not, because it's a computer, you just see them sitting there and they look random. So here's an example hash function that is simple, which has the virtue of being easy to compute, so it's one you can kind of understand how it works. So it's a function f that takes a string object, s, and what it's going to do is start out with a hash value that's eventually going to get returned, okay? Start out with a hash value initialized to 0, and you've got a loop index I. For I equals 0 through the length or size of this string, what you're going to do is add that quantity to a hash value. Now that quantity is really the numerical offset of the letter. So, for example, A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, Z is 25. Those are lower cases, and then upper cases would be something different, but anyway, it's just a number. It basically tells, it's kind of the character number where you've normalized it, where the character lowercase a has the character number 0. So, for example, f of a, the string a is 0, f of the string b is 1. F of A, B, C, D is 0 plus 1 plus 2 plus 3. That's 0 for A, 1 for B, 2 for C, and 3 for D. Note that this doesn't, what you add only depends on the value at that location in the string, and therefore if I permute them, I'm going to get the same thing, right? This will be 1 for B, 0 for A, 4 for D, and 3, I'm sorry, 3 for D, and 2 for C. And of course, addition being completely commutative, you get the same result. So you can talk about a little theorem here. If S1 is a permutation of S2, then F of S1 and F of S2 will be. So anyway, F respects permutations, that's probably not good for pseudo-randomness. And it's probably also not good for enigma. Because, you know, let's suppose that the value, suppose 6 is your hash value. You can probably write down on one sheet of paper all possible keys, or at least a way of saying what the what the letters in that key have to be without buying range. With the exception of A, A can be repeated often because A doesn't contribute anything to the key to the hash function. But nevertheless, it's a hash function. It satisfies all the two conditions. It's a mapping from strings to unsigned integers, and it is not one-to-one. It's not, you can pretty clearly not one-to-one. Here's two strings right here and here that go to the same number. That was so-called collision. Stop me if you want to talk about any of this. Slightly improved example would be to the same as before, except in here I'm going to multiply by the index, so that if A appears in place 2, it's going to contribute different than if it's in place 1. Or place 1 versus 0. And that gives you a slightly more complicated hash function. You've improved somewhat both in enigma and pseudo randomness. Actually, I think this is not true. I think that's 0. That's multiplication by 0 right here. But anyway, so you get the idea. That now, the place of a letter as well as the value of the letter make a difference in what it contributes to the signature, and therefore permutations will give you different signatures. Nevertheless, it's a hash function as before. Here's here's an actual useful example. I will talk about the algorithm in just a second. Here are some values that were computed in this algorithm. A, B, A, B, C, D, and so on. If you look at these, for example, X, double X, triple X, four X, five X, you see, you know, here's three related things here. The numbers don't appear to be particularly related. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 related things here. The keys, the signatures don't appear to be particularly related. And you know, for all practical purposes, the naked eye would consider those to be random numbers generated, even though that we can assert here they're actually calculated using this hash function. Now, this is quite a mysterious hash function. It was invented by a professor at Florida State, as a matter of fact. Here's the algorithm, really. Professor was George Mersaglia in the stat department. He invented this to provide actually a random number generator, a pseudo-random number generator for high energy physics experiments. They turn out to be significantly better than the ones that physicists were currently using, and improve the reliability of certain kinds of conclusions in big layups like, you know, accelerator places. But anyway, it also makes a good hash function. And I kind of adapted it over to be a hash function. Now, the significant points are it's going to return an unsigned int, which for all practical purposes we can think of as being a 2-byte or 16-bit integer. And it's going to work internally with an unsigned long, which is a 32-bit integer. And the idea is it's going to compute, it's going to mix things up in that bigger space of 32-bit integers. You can kind of think of it as, you can think of it kind of like this. 16-bit integers plotted on that axis and 32-bit integers this whole space here. So what this does is mix things up one character at a time. It starts off with big val, that's your 32-bit value, being the first string character. And then for each string character, what it does is go through this mixing process. So it takes big val and 65535. Well, big val is the first time, that does no effect because this is going to be a 16-bit number. So this, ending with 65535 is like taking these low order 16 bits. That's 2 to the 16 minus 1. But when you end with that, that's 2 bytes of zeros followed by 2 bytes of ones. And that just peels off the low order 16 bits. But then you multiply by this magic number, and that takes you up into here somewhere off of the 16-bit axis. And then you add to that the big val. The upper, this is the high 16 bits of big val. So this takes the low 16 bits of big val, multiplied by the magic number, adds to it the high 16 bits of big val, and then adds the next character in there. So it's kind of like big val at each stage is some number here, and it winds around to some other number in here. And at the very end, you project it back down to the 16-bit axis, and that's the number you return. So there's a, I call it the mixer because it's using this bigger numerical space, and mixing it up one time for each cranking mix, each time for each character in the string, and then finally projects the result back down to 16 bits, and that's the key, that's the signature to get the turn, I think. Anyway. So that's a good example. And this is the one that's actually distributed for your use. I think it's a, there's a couple of different magic numbers you can use. And, I think I used the 18,000 magic number for hashing. There's also a distributed random number generator, and I use a different magic number for that. But they both use the Mercator mixer. So anyway, there's an example of a sufficiently complicated hash function to provide useful results. Here's some other comments about hash functions. Pseudo randomness can be improved by applying prime number dividers. So for example, if you've got a hash function, then if it has good pseudo randomness, then if you take the remainder dividing by p, where p is a fixed prime number, then that's probably got even better pseudo randomness. Chris Locker? Yeah. Nope. I know. I'll call you if I do. No, I won't forget, I promise. Yeah. Sorry about that. Everybody's right. Burning up their way. So dividing by, taking the remainder dividing by something p is also has the added side benefit of restricting the range of the keys to be in the range of 0 for p minus 1. And that turned out to be handy later on when we talk about tables. The big book is even more esoteric than pseudo-randomness and harder to get. But hashing is used for secure signatures, the typical case being a password authentication system. Here's the way it works in a typical login, a typical secure login environment. You, the user, you have a password that you remember. When you enter that password, a signature is computed, and that signature will be built off your password and your username, which means that if two different users happen to choose the same password, they'll still have different signatures. That is computed with a hash function, that number. And that number is stored in actually a public file in somewhere. Again, the idea being you don't want your security to be based on keeping one secret, like the password file secret. So you just make it public. But it's not, what you have to understand is the thing that's stored in there is the secure signature, not the password. And then when you want to go log in, the hash function, which is also publicly known, computes a hash value off of the thing you enter the password. That gets you a signature, a proposed signature, and that is compared to what's stored in the file for your signature. If those agree, then you're authenticated. But again, the signature is only a number that's computed off of your password and username, and there's no way to reverse it and figure out what your password is, which is why if you call the system group in Tallahassee, they can't tell you what your password is. They do not know. Believe me, they do not want it. So what they can do is just allow you to change your password based on other kinds of authentications, and doing that verbally over the phone is probably the most secure thing, but it's better than, it's kind of a compromise. But the interesting thing is that suppose you get an account on a new machine or in a new environment, they can tell you to go ahead and use your password on the other system for the new system, and all they got to do is copy that signature over to the new system. It's using the same algorithm that'll allow you into a new system. And they never have to know your password. Now, that principle is the principle under which the password server is designed, and that's the subject of your work, Project 1. Now, you're going to have Chapter 6 and 7 under your belt before you'll be able to do Project 1. 5, 6, or 7. The next thing I want to talk about is templates. Everybody here had that before, right? We all had it last semester.
Yeah.
Let me quickly dive
into Chapter 1.
Mm-hmm. So templates are basically the idea is to use a parameter as a placeholder for type. You can have both functions can be templated and classes can be templated. Now, type T is used in the code as though it were a defined type, but it isn't. Any type substituted for T is typically assumed to be proper in the sense that it is responsible for its own memory management. Also, any legal identifier may be used, any legal C++ identifier may be used for the name of that parameter. I'm going to use capital T in this discussion, but it could be anything else, any legal identifier. So, functions. Here's some example functions. I'm going to define a function called largest. So, return an int. It's going to take an integer array defined or received by a pointer to type int together with a size parameter. Those pointers might be able to go with a size. Here is assumed to be an array. And what it's going to do is return the largest element of that array. And you all could write that code. You can, of course, start out with the current largest being the pointer at index 0. And then you keep testing current largest against the dereference of the pointer. And if it's less than that, then you say current largest to be whatever that current value is. And then you increment the pointer. That's the way go to the next array. Stop when size collides with zero, and then you've done exactly, you've looked at every element in the input array to the function, and current largest was the first largest element that you found, so you just return it. So then you might say, well, I'd like to have that for floats as well, so you define float largest float star, and assign the size. You've got to change the int type here to float here, but the code's exactly the same. Int and float. It can replace my float for this current largest local variable as well. Now notice that C++, as a what seemed like a nice convenience, allowed you to overload that function name. So you have the same name being used twice. They're distinguished by the compiler because the two parameter lists are different. They're the same length, but they're different types. So everything's okay. Oh, you might want another one for a double. So you would just make a copy of this one and change float to double to the editor, and that gives you one to float. And you use those like this. Declare an int array of size 20, float array of size 30, a double array of size 40, and you could output the largest int array, comma 20, and the largest float array, comma 30, and the largest double array, comma 40. The cool thing about C++ is the compiler finds the correct overloading for each one of those columns. Those are really the same name, but those are really three different functions being called, and they're distinguished by the types of the arguments that you're substituting. But this could go on. I mean, there's 8 or 10 native types. There's char, unsigned char, int, unsigned int, long, unsigned long. I forgot about short. Unsigned short, float, and unsigned float, float, double, and long double. That's 11 types that are native. And then there's all kind of types that people might invent that will have a less than operator. And you might want to calculate the largest. You might have the less than, we've already overloaded the less than operator for string objects. You might want to know, well, what is the largest string in this collection, for example. And so, what happens is you have this proliferation of having to repeat the code every time you bring in a new type that you want to calculate the largest. And what C++ does is allow you a solution to that, which is really facilitated by the overloading principle. And it says, well, heck, let's just define a template. You use the keyword template, substitute a type name, and name that parameter, which I've called capital T here, which you could call anything else. You could call it number, or number underscore type, if you want. And, repeat that code one time with T substituted for, say, here. Here, and here, and I probably should have made that one red too, because that also needs to be a type too. That's the thing you're actually returning. And what the compiler will do is essentially an edit job. It will figure out that it needs, let's say, a largest for type float, and it'll substitute float for T and compile that code. So if the compiler has to only become an editor, it's kind of a pre-processing stage, in order to make template functions work. Critical thing was the ability to overload the names, and then from the leap from there to parameterizing the types was kind of a shorter jump. So you can make this one definition, and then you can do things like declare in arrays and define some other type, which I haven't called complex. It's not a native type. And you can calculate the largest from in array, the largest from float array, the largest from double array, and the largest from complex array. And the compiler will figure out which one of these to do based on this template over here. And this is a user-defined type, and all it requires is that that user-defined type only requires that we can assign it and compare it to the less than operator. So any user, any type for which you can assign, that has an assignment operator and a less than operator, this template function can be used for. Furthermore, if you have a type for which one of those doesn't exist, you'll get a compiler. It'll say, I don't know how to do largest because I'm missing this operator for that type, or whatever that type might be. Which is pretty cool. Here's another example of a function template, really useful, and I call it swap. It's a template, type name is T. I'm going to pass in two type T elements by reference, T1 and T2. I have a local type T thing called temp, which initializes to be T1. And then I let T1 be equal to, be assigned to be a copy of T2. And I let T2 be assigned to be a copy of temp. And then the function returns. Notice that it's void. And this is classic pass by reference. So these are passed in by reference, which means that the value exchange here is affected in the calling process, because these are references back to the place where this was called. And so the way this would be used is, you know, swap of AB just exchanges the values of AB through that call, and swap of IJ exchanges the values of IJ. Now this is a useful little device that avoids, what it does is replace three lines of code that can be messed up with one call that's hard to mess up. And that call can be made for any two types. Any two objects of the same type. The only thing that's assumed about that type is it has an assignment operator. Any type that has an assignment operator can call swap on, as long as the compiler has access to this in the library and you've included it, you're fine. And you might say, well, but you know, making all these little calls to swap inside of another algorithm makes inefficient code, but not really. Good compilers will optimize by inline code like this typically. So all it really does is make the code more readable and less error prone. So it's highly recommended practice. Oh, look, those are all functions. You can also make template classes. That's on the end of the same keyword template, same kind of syntax, type name T. Here you can put, by the way, either type name or class. And they have identical meaning, really, in this context. What has become good practice is use type name whenever, use type name to indicate that native types or user-defined types can be placed there. And use class when native types won't do, and it has to be some user-defined type. So this is a class that has nothing but public stuff in it. It's a class called pair, has a default constructor and a two-parameter constructor. It's got a first element and a second element. So for example, the two-parameter constructor makes the first element initialize to T1, and the second element initialize to T2. You could elaborate this a lot and build up other stuff on it, but that's the basic idea. And this is a way you can find notion pair logics. The neat thing about this is that's pair is a single entity. So for example, if you want to store a vector, it's going to be a part of your project. If you want to store pairs of things as vector elements, this is the way to do it. Something like a pair. Because remember, you can only put one item in a vector element. If that item is a pair, so be it. Pair. And this example shows that you're not restricted to one template parameter. See, there's an example where you've got two template parameters. Again, it's a pair, but it's, you know, two different templates, two different types. The first has type T1, the second has type T2. Other than that, it'll be pretty much the same. Template code cannot be translated to object code. If you think about a template function, for example, the compiler can't make object code out of that because the template parameter is undefined. So when part of what need to be able to do when you make object code is to map map the code into specific locations in memory. So the variable eventually becomes a place to remember stuff in memory. And in order to know, in order to make that mapping into memory, you've got to know how much memory you need for variables. And if you haven't specified what type T is, and it's all algorithm or whatever it is, it's all type T all the way through it, then there's no way to make a memory map for it. So basically, there's research being done on ways around that, like having sort of precursor object code that has placeholders that can be substituted at the last minute. But for the time being, it's, and for the current state of technology and powers, it's best to just go with the statement that you can't make object code out of templates. And what happens, therefore, is template code files are not organized the same way as regular code files. Regular code files are organized with header file and code implementation file, two separate files. And this implementation file can be compiled to object code, and in fact, put in a library if you want to, which is what happens with things like IOSRAM and so on. That object code ends up being pre-compiled in a library. Or if you're not pre-compiling it, like with one of your projects, you're not pre-compiling it, still it can be compiled separately from the header file. The header file stays at kind of a high level state for inclusion into other programs. So the header file is where everything is defined, and the implementation file is where the code making it work actually exists. So with a template, either function or class, you can't do that, and so the custom is to put everything in the header file. So the template code will have the template function will have the function prototype, well, and the function implementation in the same file. And in fact, there's really not much point in putting the prototype in there because the header of the implementation serves as the first of the prototype. So you just put the function in there, period, in the file, the template function. With template classes, what you do is you get the template class definition, and then below that in the same file, you get the implementation of all the methods of that template class. And all those methods of a template class have to be template functions, because typically there's a parameter T floating around that has to be dealt with in those implementations. Now, when I say they're in the same file, let's say, I mean that logically they're in the same file. Physically, there might be a reason for separating into several physical files. But as long as you have all but one of those files essentially a slave to the header file, then they all logically appear to be in the same file. The way you make them slaves is you include them. Like let's say you've got something like tvector.cpp where you've implemented the template class tvector. As long as you include tvector.cpp inside of the header file, and when you include the header file in the program, you're automatically including everything. So as long as you make the, if you break it up into more than one file, as long as all of them are slave files to the header file, then it's still logically all like in one file. Is that making sense? The other thing you want to do is, like with any header file, use the if and def define and if mechanism to protect against multiple reads. Okay, so finally, we can talk about our first template class, and it's going to be a vector. So this is our vector wish list. We would like it to be templated so that you can make vectors of any type T, any proper type T. We'd like to be able to set the size of a vector or reset the size of a vector at runtime. We'd like to have a bracket operator that's safe. That is to say, the vector bracket operator tells us if we, and gives an error message if we try to access an index that's not part of the vector. We'd like to have an assignment operator. Notice that in this wish list so far, none of these things are true for arrays, right? So these are all improvements on arrays. But on the other hand, we'd kind of like for it to act like an array when it's convenient for it to act like an array. So that the syntax, for example, the bracket operator, is exactly the familiar syntax that you're used to using with arrays. So you can do V bracket I, and that's just like behaving just as though it were an array. And we want it to be a proper type, the vector itself to be a proper type, so it's going to have a suite of constructors, a copy constructor, a destructor, and we got to do automatic memory management so that you can declare vector objects and change their size without ever worrying about memory management. You can treat it pretty much like an ordinary variable. So that's sort of a nice collection of desired properties. So those, of course, affect both the public interface and the way we have to, and the implementation plan for this class, right? So we have to kind of feel our way along here. For the public interface, we will have a bracket operator, assignment operator, a set size, a set capacity constructor, not a destructor. The implementation plan, well, we will maintain a protected C array called content. And that's where elements are stored. And we'll maintain two protected parameters, size and capacity. Size will be the logical number of elements in the vector. Capacity is going to be the size of the memory footprint that's currently allocated. So one of the things you have to do here is maintain the relationship that size is less than or equal to capacity always. We're going to end up having to do a lot of memory allocation, and whenever we do memory allocation, we want to check, do a safety check on the allocation request. And for that not to become horribly boring to the point where we might decide not to do the safety check, we'll do it right, do it once, and isolate it in a separate function. So we got to manage the memory and the data for the user when appropriate. So we'll have to investigate what that means. So here's the proposed public interface. Let's take a look at it. A default constructor, presumably that would make a vector of size 0, right? A constructor with a size parameter and a type T parameter, and the effect of this would be to make a vector of that size and initialize all the elements with that T object. A copy constructor and a destructor. So we got a default constructor, a two-parameter constructor, a copy constructor, and a destructor. We have the assignment operator, we have the bracket operator. We're going to be able to set the size, and we'll be able to specify the size and, again, a value that gets, if you make the vector bigger, that would be the initializing value for the extra places you're predating. Set capacity, and then we've got a size and a capacity. Just tell us what those two things are, inform patients. I'll come back to this in a moment, so-called container class protocols. So how do we go about this? Oh, we got some non-member operators as well. The output operator, we're not going to try to do an input operator for vectors. We're an output operator, an equality operator, and a non-equality operator. Notice that those are template operators, template functions. Everything depends on this type T, which is not known at this point. And then finally, so this will be the plan for the file itself. We're going to call it tvector.h, put some general documentation in here and so forth, protect it against multiple reads with if and def, put it inside the FSU namespace. This will be where our code defining tvector goes. And then finally, we're going to include the slave file, tvector.cpp, right here. Notice that it's included inside the namespace and inside the protection, which means that neither protection nor namespace needs to be part of that file, but that's purely a slave file to tvector.h. And this is just like an edit job, right? This just sucks it in before any translation occurs. So it's as if the code was already stuck right in here, inside the namespace and inside the protection, the multiple read protection. This protection against multiple reads is provided by the master file, and therefore not necessary here. And the namespace is provided by the master file, so that's not necessary here. We are going to have some static, that is to say, file scope constants of type. One file scope constant called the default capacity, and set it equal to something, say 10. And that's going to be the capacity of a vector. When you make a vector and you don't specify its size, it'll come up with size 0, but it'll have capacity 10. That's what that's going to be used for. Okay. So first, here's that thing that gets us a new array and does a safety check. So this is a method called new array. It takes a parameter that I'm going to call just new capacity here, but it's just a parameter. It's supposed to return a pointer to type T. So that's the externals, that's the footprint of it, that's the prototype. Inside, you're going to have a locally declared pointer, a T pointer. And if the parameter passed in is positive, then I'm going to ask for a new C array of that size. Right, that's a request to the operating system for a block of memory. And the operating system will either put a legitimate address in there for me and allocate that memory, or it will put 0 in there to signify that it cannot grant my request for memory. So you always check if T pointer equals 0, then that means you didn't get your allocation, and so you send an error message. And possibly do other things, at least send an error message. So anyway, if you get to this point, you've got your T allocated. Now, this else, that's when U capacity equals zero, and then, you know, if you requested something of zero capacity, which is not clear why you would, but just in case somebody did, you want to make sure you send them from zero pointer in return, and then finally just return this thing. So this kind of covers the basis of checking to make sure the allocation happened right, and covering the boundary case of somebody foolishly requesting a memory allocation of size zero. Notice that size T, size underscore T, is an unsigned type, so requesting a negative amount would be not possible. You protect against that other thing. This is an unsigned type. So, vector constructor, default constructor. We're going to set size to zero and capacity to the default capacity. This is arguably unnecessary. Content is that pointer to the footprint. I'm going to initialize it to zero in this initialization list, but it immediately will get a different value here, presumably. Content equals new array of capacity. Note the simplicity of that call, and it is made simple and safe by the fact that all the ins and outs of error checking are handled by the function call itself, and you don't have to keep repeating it here in the constructor. Okay? The two-parameter constructor, you have a size parameter coming in, so in that case, we're going to assume the client knows what it wants. I say yes because the client's already programmed, right? And so I set both size and capacity to be that number, and set content to be an array, a footprint allocated to exactly that size. And then finally, I initialize all the elements of that array to be the incoming key value. And let me point out that suppose you want to declare a vector, but you don't know how big you're going to need it till later. And you can legitimately do that statically, like this. You gotta figure out which side of this thing is going. So in your client, you're writing your client program, all you gotta do is include tvector.h, and then down in here you can do T vector of int v. Now let's examine that. V with nothing after it, semicolon. That will be a call for the default constructor. So this will be a vector of size 0 and footprint or capacity 10 at this point. Or capacity equal default capacity, whatever that constructor set up. suppose down the road here, you figure out you're going to need, you might input some number n from a user, and then you need to change the size of this. Set size n. This will change the size from this will change the size to n, and probably if n is bigger than 10, also change the capacity to something bigger. So the point I want to make is that a better choice here would have been to substitute 0 here, which would make a vector of size 0, which is effectively the one with no capacity. That'll be a vector with no capacity, so there'll be no dynamic memory allocated to it at that point, and then this will allocate dynamic memory to it for the first time. If you do it the other way, you allocate 10 slots, which then have to be thrown away and reallocated 20 slots to accommodate this in. So that initial allocation is just a waste of time and space. The destructor is just you delete the content array. And you want to be sure to use the bracket version of delete. If you haven't ever done it, it's interesting to write a little program that compares delete with and without the bracket. I have one in the examples of your library, your code library. It'll do that for you. It'll demonstrate that delete without the bracket will not call the constructor for all the delete on, so it'll call it only for the first delete on. The delete with the brackets will call the destructor for all the delete on. And that, of course, is what you want. Assignment operator, let's just talk about what we want to do here. Assignment operator returns a reference to the vector. And it has a... another vector coming in. That you want to, what you want to do is make this vector and copy off that vector. There's dynamic memory involved here, and therefore you want to play strictly guard against self-assignment. Because the first thing you're going to do in an assignment like this is going to be a couple steps. The first step is to deallocate the memory that's assigned to this, and the next step is to reallocate precisely the correct amount of memory to make a copy of that. Well, if this equals that, then the deallocation phase destroys that, which you're trying to make a copy of, and you just blow it, like, can't get it back. So, you always want to check against self-assignment. And the way you do that is compare addresses. Things have the same address that they are the same logic. Right? So you do that by something like the address of this is my address, and the address of B is ampersand B. So that, whatever you do inside of there, and then the last thing you do is return the reference, self-reference to this object outside of that. So if this is equal to the incoming, then you just return the self-reference and do nothing. Because if it's the same object, they're certainly pretty equal to that. Okay, so you check against self-reference. Then what you want to do is, the quick version of this would be content. Make size equals B dot size. Make capacity equals B dot capacity. And make content equal new array. Capacity. And then what you've done so far is make sure that the footprint of that this footprint is identical in size to that footprint and different. And now what you want to do is copy the data over all the time. So you do the whole loop. Now less than probably you can get by the size plus I. You do content by equals B by content. That's really all you have to do right here. Now the logic of this is slightly more complex by simply observing that, hey, if they happen to already be the same size, it's pointless to throw away the memory and get it back exactly the same amount. And so what that does is say, well, are they the same size or not? If they are, don't do anything. If they're not, then do this. And then once you've gotten past that, then do the copying. But that's just a slight optimization. This certainly works. Bracket operator. Remember, the underlying C array, of course, has a bracket operator itself. So you could just return content bracket I for your bracket operator. But we said we wanted to check for errors. So we'll check to see that whether I is bigger than size or not. It'd be an error unless I is less than size, right? You check that, and if it is, send an error message. And possibly exit. And if it's not, then you return that. Notice we're returning a reference to it, which means that you can put it on the left-hand side of the assignment statement. Put B bracket out on the left-hand side of the assignment statement, just like you can before. And then the non-member operator overloads. For example, how would you do equality? Well, one thing to do is, by the way, notice that these were not named as friends, so you got to figure out a way to do it without using any private or protected data. So you can say, well, first, if they're different size, then obviously they're not equal. So you return zero. Then you got to, if they are the same size, then you got to do an element by element check, right? So you do start at zero and go through size, which is the same for both vectors, and compare the elements. If the elements are not equal, if you ever find the element place where they're not equal, then again, the vectors are not equal, and so you return zero. If you get through that whole loop and you didn't find any unequal elements, then what have you got? You got equal size and equal elements, so they must be equal vectors in return. And the usual cop-out here, it's not really a cop-out, it's good reuse of code, define not equals as to be not, in terms of not the equality operator. That guarantees that if you ever go and change the equality operator to something different, for example, you might decide, well, you know, maybe I should check it all the way through capacity. You might decide that. Then that would be a corresponding logical change necessary for not equals. This would make that automatic. And then you have kind of the display methods, you know, how do you output the elements of an array? Well, you know, this display, the thing to notice here is my display has two parameters, an O-string parameter and an output formatting character. And the idea is that if that output formatting character is the null character, then I just output the contents of the array with nothing in between. If it's any other character, then you output the contents of the array with the output formatting character in between. This often has a default value, but the place where you define that default value would be in the class definition, not in the implementation function. And just to get you used to it, I also have something called dump here. Display and dump have two different purposes. Display has the purpose of being client friendly. You use it to implement the output operator, but more generally, you make it available to clients who might want to display the context of the vector for whatever purpose. And they may want tabs in between, they might want each element on a different line. They might want nothing in between, and they can control that by the output formatting character. The dump function is for the developer, not the client. The dump function is to give you as near as possible a picture of the internal structure of this entity. Now, the internal structure of a vector is not hard to visualize just from knowing what the elements are. But nevertheless, because we're going to have other things later where the dump function gives you a rather complicated picture of the internal workings of something. Just to carry that tradition, start it here where it's easy, we'll go ahead and do it. So notice what dump does. If the size is zero, it outputs just a pair of parentheses. Otherwise, it outputs a paren, and then the zero element. And then from one, not zero, through size, it outputs a comma, followed by the next element. And then finally, outputs a closing paren. So the net effect of this is to display the vector as paren, element, comma, element, comma, element, comma, element, close paren. And that's for the developer's use. Typically, if you have a dump function, you would sort of move it into the private sector of the class, or just simply remove it when you distribute it to the client for client use in the library. It serves no client purpose. Clients should have no legitimate reason to know the internal structure of something. In fact, sometimes it's bad for them to know it because they're tempted to try to use it in some way. And that's usually not good for the client. Not good. Set capacity is another kind of intricate thing. By the way, I don't know if you're keeping count, but we've used this new array thing a gazillion times already, so it turned out to be a good move to isolate that into a function. Set capacity, the idea is you pass in a new capacity, and then there's a bunch of cases. It can be zero, in which case you got one thing to do. It could have been equal to the old capacity, is another possibility, right? And in that case, you really don't want to do anything. If it's not equal to the old capacity, then you want to essentially throw away the old content, but first get a new content array and copy the data from the old content to the new content. And that's complicated slightly by the fact that the old size and the capacity might be going up and it might be going down. So you have to worry about that a little bit too. But taking into account all those things, you basically, the idea is, in principle, create a new footprint, copy the data from the old footprint to the new footprint. The new footprint is smaller, then you copy as much data as you can. If it's bigger, you copy all the data. And once you've made that copy, you throw what you delete, give back to the operating system the allocation for the old one. That's all taken care of by the set capacity function or whatever. A set size will just call set capacity, and only when it needs to. So there's a subtle difference here. Set capacity is a direct order from the client to make the footprint exactly this size, this amount. Set size is less of a direct order about the footprint. It just says I need to change the size of my vectors to so-and-so. And it doesn't really say anything directly about the footprint or capacity. So what you do with set size is, if it's possible to change the size without changing the capacity, you do it. And the only way that, the only way you would need more capacity is if the new size is bigger than the capacity you currently have. And if that's the case, then you have to obviously set the new capacity first. And that's what's going on in that if statement here. If the new size that you're requesting is bigger than your current capacity, then you've got to set capacity to new size. Notice, set capacity has an integer return value, which we interpret as Boolean. It's going to return a 1 if it is successful, a 0 otherwise. So, and the same with set size, it'll return a 1 if it's successful and a 0 otherwise. So, by changing the capacity to new size, actually this code isn't quite right. This is like, this is kind of the, front, the way it should work. You check to see if new size is greater than capacity. If it is, then you set the capacity to that new size. But first you have to set size equal to new size. So this line of code really should have been maybe up here. Okay, I guess that works. So the point is, if set capacity is true, then you keep going, you reset, change size, return 1. The only time you have to return 0 is if your request to change the size is failed. Of course, then I guess all you can do is just not grant the request. So I guess that code's okay. This, when you write a code for a slide, you don't have the luxury of a compiler to check it for you. So be careful sometimes. Anyway, clear for a vector is just set the size to 0. That makes it easy. All right, now we're getting to something. Now we're going to get to this. I think it's time. I'm going to take a break. Don't want to take a 5-minute break?